As I tell almost everyone, I have a home in Montgomery, Alabama, where I keep my stuff, and I actually live in a white pickup truck.
Live in a white pickup truck. Traveling as a migrant bander, which probably there aren't too many of those. But
no, I'm the only bander that truly travels almost all the time banding hummingbirds.
And so you were telling me yesterday that you kind of band in the southeast in the wintertime when the birds are south, and then you come out west and
that's,
north.
That's correct. In the wintertime, I'm the hummingbird bander in South Alabama and Florida. And the real reason I'm out here is because I've banded in the last 15 years about 2,000 rufus there, mm-hmm. and I'm convinced that those birds are coming out of Alaska. Mm-hmm. And I'm out here to try to prove that.
So rufus hummingbirds, if I understand correctly, have they wintered in the southeast for a long time, or is that kind of a recent thing that they've been showing up there more? Or
well, as far as I'm concerned, they've been doing it for a long, long time. People didn't know about it because up until people like me came along and started doing winter banding, everyone was told they have to take down their feeders by a certain date. They were good soldiers, so they took their feeders down. And then if they did happen to see a hummingbird or a flower or anything and they reported it to Fish and Game or Audubon or something, they were told, I know you thought you saw a hummingbird, but there's no hummingbird during the winter. That was a moth. I came along and started giving talks about leaving feeders out, and not only do I believe you have a hummingbird, I'll come to your house and catch it. Amazingly enough, western hummingbirds started to show up. I think they've been doing that for a long, long time. The only thing that's happened in the last 20 years is we've gotten a little bit smarter about what's going on
yeah.
in nature.
And so when you say a western hummingbird, most of the hummingbird diversity sort of in the west in
right.
terms of North America?
East of the Great Plains in the United States, the only hummingbird that nests is a ruby-throated hummingbird.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And everything else is west of there. And they're, depending on how it's counted, 13 to 17 species of hummingbirds
yeah.
out west.
That are nesting?
Yes.
Yeah. And then there's a bunch more south. But
yeah, we're going on into Mexico and that
yeah.
sort of thing. But so nesting there. And there's only like four or five species that nest there in large numbers. But
yeah.
a few of them right down along the Arizona border and stuff like that.
Yeah. So pretty much any hummingbird back east other than a ruby throat is
yes.
interesting.
Absolutely.
And so as you've been banding for 20 years, 20-some years?
Well, I started working with birds about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I've been a master bander for about 15 years now.
Yeah. And a master bander just means that you're able to work on your own permit.
Right.
And
I have my
sort of
own permit with the federal government, and I come up with my own research projects and that sort of thing.
And I noticed as people were, you know, as the emails were kind of going around mentioning that you were coming up, there would be people that were, excuse me, a little... They were concerned. They're worried about hummingbirds. You know, they're like, I guess they understand these are kind of delicate little creatures.
I understand that. I deal with that all the time. People see a hummingbird and they think it's such a delicate creature that you can't possibly handle them without hurting them. But I understand that, and I don't ever try to talk anyone into banding.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'll tell you, I think you saw yesterday.
Yeah.
Anyone who's ever watched me ban hummingbirds says, oh, yeah, they're just fine. You're not hurting anything. And they're actually much tougher creatures than they appear to be.
Yeah.
My standard answer is they're actually just tough as nails and mean as snakes.
They do seem to be a little aggressive at times, especially
they're
these rufous
seriously
ones.
Seriously aggressive.
Yeah. So, I guess just to describe it, I helped you out a bit yesterday, and you have these kind of wire cages. With a door that's on a string, and you let go of the string, drops the door.
Right, I call it a vertical sliding door that
okay.
I call them.
Mm-hmm. And so you take where the hummingbird feeder is located, and you just put the cage right around it.
Right, they come
the same
much faster if you put it right back where it was.
And so they have a pattern that they're used to, and they'll go in and so you know, usually it was that, you know, a hummingbird would show up and kind of. Like, it'd have to search around the cage a
right.
little bit to find the opening, then go in and you drop the thing. And if you tried to lower it slowly, it would actually, the hummingbird's faster.
Oh, absolutely.
So they jumped right back out. And but you drop it, and then you just reach in there and grab it. And then they seem relatively, most of them, not all of them, a couple of them were a little less docile.
Yeah,
but
most of them are just calm right down. I tell people, hummingbirds aren't afraid of anything. They just
yeah.
don't know what's going on. And as soon as you get them under control, they just calm right down. And
yeah.
They're just not bothered by the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so they seem to be pretty calm, and it was fun to watch people. They just, you put them in their, they held their hand out flat, and you set them down. And Some of them right away took off. Others waited a few seconds and then took off.
Right.
So it's interesting just to see, I guess, different personalities with different birds.
It is. It takes some of them longer to figure out that they're not confined anymore.
Yeah.
And those tend to sit there longer. But people really enjoyed having a creature like that just sit in their hand.
And is it pretty similar then for all the different kind of hummingbirds that you banned?
Yes.
It's just the different species in different locations.
Right.
And of course, in Alaska, by far the most common hummingbird is rufous hummingbird. And there are nesting birds and here throughout the summer. We get the occasional stray annas. And I think there's at least one other species that's been reported as a vagrant. It's maybe calliope or...
There's at least two or three records of Costas hummingbird.
Oh, Costas, that's right.
Here in... I know of at least one, and I think there's more than one record of ruby-throated hummingbirds.
Oh, really?
Yeah, one of those is from way up north, but that bird was lost. It was dead. It just, nobody told it yet.
Yeah, they get the... I was talking to somebody the other day, and they said when a migration, the most common, error in migrational sense is 180 degrees opposite.
And sometimes it's 90 degrees.
Sometimes it's 90.
Right.
And so then you'll find these birds, and they end up in Alaska, then they end up sort of funneled down river systems and totally lost by that point. And that's how you get these vagrants out at Gamble or, up at Barrow or in places like that. But
yeah, but in that, the worst thing that people can do, and a lady in Juneau had tried to do that last winter. People find these birds out and they try to catch them. This lady wanted to put an anna's on an airplane and fly it down to Oregon somewhere and let it go. And that's absolutely the worst thing you can do, because then the creature has no idea where it is whatsoever, and it has no idea. Used to, in the eastern United States, when we first started getting western hummingbirds, people, oh, it's a poor lost thing. And they actually would put them on an airplane, fly them to Texas down to the Mexican border and say, you're free now.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
That bird's going to die because it doesn't know it's in Texas.
Yeah.
Let nature take its own course.
Yeah. Well, and the annas are pretty hardy. There's been a couple of years over the last, three or four that annas have wintered here. A couple of them and elsewhere in Southeast as well. Usually what happens is people forget to take down their feeders, and then they have often it's a late rufous is what they're thinking. And then,
and I get the same thing when I first started years ago, people would forget to take a feeder down, and the bird would always be described to me as a ruby-throated that didn't leave.
Didn't leave, yeah.
And it's not. It's going to be something else.
Something else. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. I remember you were telling me yesterday that there's birders and people that feed birds and stuff, but feeding hummingbirds seems to be a different... I mean, there's overlap, but there's definitely a set of people that don't really do much with birds except feed hummingbirds.
Right. And I told you that the reason for that is because we interact with hummingbirds, people, they know who fills their feeder, they're curious about us, and so you get to see them up close and see the antics and that sort of thing. And I tell people all the time, the best stress relief in the world is to come home in the evening and get your favorite beverage and just sit out and watch the Hummer Wars.
Watch them, right. And chasing each other. And I've heard more than one person talk about, when their feeder went empty, or they forgot to put it up early enough, they'll come knock on the window.
Oh, absolutely. And you can look at them and you can tell exactly what they're saying. They say, you're falling down on your job. Get my feeder out here. And not being polite about it either.
Yeah, come out and feed us. So it is kind of fun. And yesterday we got a chance to go out to Medvici Hatchery. And a person I've had on the show before, Lucy Phillips, she used to live out there and started feeding hummingbirds. I don't know. It's been quite a while. And over the years, the numbers increased out there. And now I guess we caught over 70 yesterday out there.
Yeah, we banded 72 yesterday. Mm-hmm. And if we'd gotten there earlier and kind of worked, we would have broken 100 easy. But yeah. I was very happy with 72.
Yeah, it was just kind of amazing at times. I think they had four hummingbird feeders set up around the house. And so one of the things you do is actually take down the feeders that aren't going to be in a cage.
Right. Choice can't be part of the deal because they'll go to the one that's not in a trap. They're not stupid.
Yeah. So it did that, and so that all kind of brought them to the front where there was just a couple. But there were times when, like, if you just sort of looked with your wide-angle vision, there was 20 or 30 in the air right in front of you.
Oh, absolutely.
Just buzzing around. And, of course, you know, as you band them, that was one of the things that discovered banding juncos last fall, is that there was this sort of constant amount of birds there, but you had banded a bunch, and most of them still weren't banded. And it was always most of them still weren't banded. And so... So it seemed like with hummingbirds, the same kind of thing happens. They're moving through a lot more than you might realize.
That's exactly right. People always have more birds of any species than they think they do. They think they have the birds they see right in front of them right now. But the birds you see next hour are quite often a totally different set of birds.
Yeah. Somebody told me that the whale researchers often say multiply by two or three from what you see. And that's probably more likely how many whales are actually there, because you're only seeing a couple at a time.
Right.
And others are down
below.
You know,
I certainly don't have the experience to tell you out here, but back in the east during the fall migration, I tell people to counterestimate the most birds you can see at any one time and multiply that by six.
Yeah.
And that's the number you're actually feeding. And I can prove that by going into your yard. And if you tell me you got 20, I'll ban 120. Just consistently ban about six times as many as you tell me.
Oh, that's interesting. And so for people that have been banning over the years, it sounds like that there's enough. Well, I guess age-wise, they can live to be a decade or more.
That's correct.
And
yeah, I've caught rufous hummingbirds for as many as 9 years in a row, and that's every year for 9 years. And I think the age record for rufous is between 10 and 11 years.
Okay.
And that's certainly at the end of the bell curve.
Yeah.
We think the average lifespan is more like 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. And so that includes probably a relatively high mortality for young birds. And then once they make it, then there's a better chance.
With hummingbirds, we estimate that about 80% of the young birds don't make it through the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually about the same for almost all species of birds.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of the, you know, it comes up with gulls, because gulls go through, a 4-year cycle
right
before they become mature. And so your most numerous gulls at any time are usually first-year birds and adults. Because the adults,
yes,
once they all look that way, you know, they could be anywhere from 4 to 30, you know. But then those second and third year, there's a lot of attrition between that first, second, and third year.
Well, and that's what I tell people with hummingbirds. If they make it through the first year, then they've got a good chance of living to a fair age. But it's tough getting through that first year.
Yeah. So you're actually recapturing, and this is in the southeast, presumably, for these rufous hummingbirds, again. So they're showing a certain amount of fidelity to where they're going in the winter?
Oh, absolutely. I did a 10-year study of winter hummingbirds in Alabama and Florida that I published 3 years ago. And with female rufous over that time period, I got about a 20.8% return rate.
Mm.
And if you know banders, that's a really high return rate.
It sounds like it.
What you find with these birds is if you band on their nesting grounds or on their wintering grounds, you get a real good return rate.
Yeah.
If you're banding birds in migration, you get a very, very low return rate, but you have a probability of those birds being caught in other locations.
Yeah.
And so you can learn about migration from them.
Okay. That's interesting. You know, we had a talk on black oyster catchers a while back, and he talked about banding those, and they had, I think, a 90% return to nesting, like the same nesting place for adults. But they'd banded, I think, hundreds or maybe over 1,000 immature birds and had 5 returns or something. They have no idea where those immature birds are going, but they're not coming back to where they were nested,
but
hatched out. So,
but hummingbirds do.
And hummingbirds will come back. So.
Right. And I had some DNA work done a few years ago, and the only thing that I really proved out of that I really wanted to know is there are places where I've been banding rufous hummingbirds at the same house for 15 years.
Yeah.
And some of those birds actually were descendants of birds who had been there early. They were able to do that with mitochondrial DNA studies.
Oh, that's interesting. I know Lucy has said that, it's the generations. Over time, the young would come back, and it just that was sort of the process that she felt like was going on as the hummingbird numbers increased there at the feeders out at the hatchery.
Yeah, what they were doing there is, first thing is, that's a kind of an isolated area,
so
and consistency. you know, having your feeders up all the time while they're there. Because if you leave the feeders down for very long, they'll tend to move out.
Yeah.
And once they do that, if they find other feeders, they'll stay there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she's built up clientele over the years,
right,
is what
right.
I call it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's interesting. And so what kind of brings you to Alaska, you said you have this a suspicion that many of the birds that are wintering in the southeast are nesting in Alaska, and presumably Alaska nesters are also going, you know, more western as well.
Yeah, I have no doubt that most of them do that. I think they are. But the real reason I'm here is the world's record between a banding and a recapture was one of my Rufus 3 years ago that a sub-bander who works for me in Tallahassee, Florida, banded in a yard in Tallahassee in January. And in June of that year, that bird was recaptured in Chininga Bay, which is an island right off Valdez. That's 3,600 miles away. And the last two winters down on Alabama's Gulf Coast, I've caught the same female Rufus, and that bird was banded in northwest British Columbia. And they don't nest there. So that bird was coming out of Alaska, cutting across, headed into the southeast. And I was giving a talk just like this on public radio telling the lady that they're coming out of Alaska, but they're not getting caught on the end because there are no hummingbird banders. And she said, "Won't you go up and find out?" Here I am.
So you've stopped already in Ketchikan and Juneau.
Correct.
And you've been here. This is your sort of second full day here.
Yeah, second full day.
Yeah. And so far here you've caught
101.
101. Mm-hmm. And what did you get in Ketchikan and Juneau?
I banded 77 in Ketchikan and 98 in Juneau.
Oh, wow. So we're good for hummingbirds. The hatchery was a big...
That was a killer to get those kind of numbers. Yeah. That was kind of the glory hole.
Yeah, and I've heard, other stories of people that live in remote places, lodges or hatcheries that feed, that have similar sort of... And actually, you know, some of the descriptions are maybe even more than the hatchery here has, and it sounds like maybe it's that isolation and consistency thing.
It is. If you go on YouTube and type in Rufus hummingbirds in Alaska, you'll see several videos of just huge numbers of Rufus hummingbirds at feeders.
Hmm. And so you were telling me that you know, you might not expect, I mean, I wouldn't have expected hummingbirds to go very far for foraging. I mean, they're small, and why would they go, you know, super extra far? But it sounds like, you know, what'd you say, that there was 6 miles away that you caught one?
That's the longest one away that I've actually caught, and that was in Tallahassee, Florida a few years ago, that I had caught and marked a bird.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually a bird I had banded previously at another home.
Yeah.
And when I marked it, so I knew which bird it was. And then I went to that other home, which was 6 miles away. And when I got there, the bird was waiting for me in the yard. Not exactly, but it was there because it had my mark on it. And it was the first time of the year down there, so I had marked no other birds. So.
Yeah.
And that's probably longer than they normally go. But in Ketchikan, one morning I banded a bird that I banded a mile and a half from there late the afternoon prior. So they do have a much larger feeding area than we used to think.
So at a minimum, that would suggest that, you know, if it happened to have a nest in the exact middle, it was going a half mile either way.
Oh, absolutely.
And
I tell people they know where every feeder within a couple of miles is.
Yeah.
They're not dependent on any one feeder.
Yeah. And so they're also, in addition to feeders, they're getting insects, catching a lot of insects.
Sure. Visiting. More than 50% of their diet is insect. That's where they get all the proteins, vitamins, minerals, and all mm-hmm. that. The sugar water we feed them gives the energy to go catch bugs.
Yeah. Hmm. And so also then visiting flowers, of course. And,
sure. If they don't. You know, what the sugar water feeder does is that's the world's most amazing, non-exhaustible flower to them.
Right,
so
right.
They have just hit the jackpot when they find it. And what it does for them is it makes their life easier.
Yeah.
That they're able to find a concentrated source without having to go to 1,000 flowers or so.
Right.
But, you know, people get worried about, well, I can't do that because if I stop feeding them, they will die.
Right.
Well, that's not true at all. They just go back out in the woods and make an honest living. So,
yeah.
The main reason we feed hummingbirds is more for our benefit, and it makes their life easier. But they're certainly not dependent on us in any way.
It sort of, I guess maybe it concentrates them a little bit in some cases where we
absolutely.
Can see them.
Yes.
But if we weren't here, they would be there just a little more dispersed.
Right. But, you know, I tell people if you don't have feeders up, you're basically not going to see hummingbirds unless you happen to have real flowers in your garden mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. But if they're not the concentrated feeder, they just scatter out all over the place, and you're much less likely to see them.
Yeah, it's been one of the other sort of interesting stories here with Rufous hummingbirds is the red-breasted sapsuckers, you know, tap wells into trees. And the hummingbirds in the spring, usually when I've heard of people seeing it, is it's in the early spring. But they'll follow the sapsuckers around and visit their wells. And I don't know whether they're getting insects or sap or both.
Both.
But, yeah.
Yeah, they both drink the sap and eat the insects that are caught in it. We have the same thing in the winter back in the southeast with yellow-bellied sapsuckers that the hummingbirds will go and get their share from that also.
Huh, that's interesting. And I guess for people that feed, you probably have maybe some tips for feeding. Sounds like consistency is one. It's important. The ratio is 3-to-1, 4-to-1.
I recommend one part sugar to four parts water.
Yeah.
People tend to think, if I make it stronger, then I will get more hummingbirds and that sort of stuff. And that may be true, but if you get the mixture higher than absolutely no more ever than 1-to-3, that it starts to get viscous, and also their kidneys have trouble excreting it. So I tell people 1-to-4, they will feed on it just as well. And if they need more, they'll just come and drink more because their biology is different than they take that in. They extract the sugar very, very quickly and excrete the water. So it's not like that they can't come back and drink more of it. And that's always safe.
Okay. And, it sounds like a consistent location is helpful.
It is. And another couple of things that when you're making your sugar water, I recommend just use regular old table sugar.
Yeah.
You know, don't try to reinvent the wheel and use organic sugar or that sort of thing. Just regular table sugar, one part sugar, four parts water, red food coloring does nothing whatsoever to attract hummingbirds.
Yeah.
That just comes from that hummingbird food that they want you to go back and buy, which is no more than table sugar with red food coloring. It costs about 5 times as much as sugar, so you don't need that. And another thing that you don't have to do, some people... You don't need to boil the water.
Yeah.
Boiling the water does no good whatsoever. The water just needs to be warm enough to dissolve the sugar. So that's all you need.
So and if you're going to be feeding, like they said at the hatchery, they went through, they'll go through 70 pounds of sugar in a summer with the amount of birds they have there. So you want to do it cheap and efficiently if you're going to be feeding lots of birds, no doubt.
That's right. But with that, if you don't have very many birds, don't fill your feeders full.
Yeah.
You know, just put enough in there. And here... don't just leave it out there indefinitely.
Yeah.
I would recommend that you don't leave it, never leave it more than 2 weeks. It'll actually spoil.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't want to drink spoiled sugar water, and neither do hummingbirds. So change it every now and again.
So, one of the things that I've read about happening is that, it starts to ferment or something like that.
It does.
And the hummingbirds may stop visiting it. It may look fine, but...
and that's what I tell people. If it's really fermented, that hummingbird's not going to come back. Another hummingbird may come to the feeder and try it, but after a while, you'll run out of birds doing that.
Right.
And it's not good for the birds, and we want to have the birds healthy, so...
It's probably a little less of an issue here where it's cooler, but it doesn't happen as fast, I imagine.
Right.
But
in the southeast there, I recommend people change their sugar water every 3 days.
So
it spoils quickly there.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess then it's putting as much in as they seem to be using, and so you're not wasting as much.
Right.
As, that makes sense. It's been interesting watching the hummingbirds, and of course people get excited talking about them, and you know when you go to the people's houses, it seems like everybody's excited to see them,
they
the
are.
And
years ago when I started doing this. I've got a very scientific background, and I was all into science, and all these ladies kept saying, son, you don't understand. This is not a bird.
Yeah.
This is a fairy / angel / spirit / something that a lot of people look at hummingbirds and they see it's more than just another animal that they just fascinate people. And I tell people over the years, I'm about halfway to where they are, that I'm absolutely taken with hummingbirds.
Yeah, I remember, I can't remember which species it was, but you said that the hummingbird essentially was part of the family, that the lady...
Well, what I tell people is, in the southeast, most people only have one hummingbird.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those hummingbirds come back for years and years, and people, they seriously know that one hummingbird.
Yeah.
They know what it's doing. They know, they'll call me and say, Mary Jane will be back next week. And then they call and say, okay, Mary Jane, she's a... out there in the tree, and she's back, and they become truly family members. I tell the I go to homes and people have pictures of hummingbirds and their grandchildren. The hummingbirds are not below the grandchildren. They're just as proud of their hummingbird as their grandchild. And they're just heartbroken when the bird doesn't return.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting sort of relationship and connection that people are able to make with them.
I'm fascinated quite often by how they affect people.
Mm-hmm.
That people see hummingbirds and you can just see them light up and they're just very, very enthusiastic about it and everything. Much more so than most things that there's a hummingbird at my house. And
yeah,
hey, that's wonderful.
They're pretty amazing. So tiny and so much. I mean, their sort of metabolism burns so bright. You know, it's that energy and assertiveness in the case of some of them. And as I remember reading, and when measured by body length, they have the longest, you know, in terms of ratio of body length to migration, they're by far the longest migrant.
And it's the same thing. I was reading a study that I'd never thought about before, but with body length and speed, if the speed is in body lengths, they're by far the fastest creature in the world.
Well, you know, having missed a couple yesterday when trying to drop the door, you know, it's amazing how fast they could back out. It's like, maybe they can actually fly backwards.
They absolutely can fly backwards. Okay. They can fly sideways, backwards, up, and they can even fly upside down. You'll watch one sometime come off a feeder and roll upside down. They won't fly that, but they can fly upside down and then roll back out.
Huh.
Yeah, there's a video that they show on PBS when they're trying to raise money, and there's a bird after a bee, and it does 3 barrel rolls.
Oh, wow.
Just after that, and it's all in slow motion, and it's one of the most amazing flying sequences you'll ever see.
Yeah, it's those guys that do that sort of video, it's pretty, I don't know how they get it all set up.
But they've got new camera, real high-speed cameras and all that kind of stuff now, and they just do some amazing work with those.
Yeah, it'd be, I haven't seen that one. It'd be fun to find that, but... So from here, you're on to Haines.
Correct.
and then hoping to get a bunch there, and then you're going to try further north.
Right. Well, then I'm going to go up into what I will call Big Alaska.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
And the up there, the hummingbirds are only along the southern coast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cordova, Valdez, Seward, Homer, down in those areas, but I really don't have hardly any contacts down there yet. I'm hoping to break in and get some contacts and band down there, but I'm not sure that's going to be 2 to 3 weeks by the time I get there, and the young may be out of the nest, and they may be starting to leave by then, so I'm not really sure. I really don't think I'm going to get near as many hummingbirds up there as I've gotten on the islands in southeast Alaska.
So I guess the terms of range for the hummingbirds, a typical range is the sort of coastal spruce hemlock rainforest, and that's kind of where that ends. They sort of stop.
Well, you know, down here, I really can't tell you that, you know, because there's nobody up there way up in the mountains out in the middle of nowhere putting up a hummingbird feeder.
Right.
So they may very well be there. But, you know, it's the if there's nobody there looking for them, we don't know if they're there or not.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think they're actually considered pretty unusual on Kodiak Island. Like, it's people are excited to see a hummingbird on
Kodiak
Island.
I think that's getting pretty far west for them. I know last year when I was thinking about coming up here, I actually saw a thing on the internet that a hummingbird was seen, and I'm going brain dead now, the city north of Anchorage, it starts with an F.
Oh, Fairbanks.
Fairbanks.
Yeah.
Somebody had seen a hummingbird in Fairbanks.
Oh, wow.
And it was the first one that had been seen there in like 10 years or so.
Oh, wow.
Somebody, one hummingbird.
Yeah.
You know, so no, they don't go that north. They're, it's too cold. They don't need to be up there with the polar bears.
it seems like you're fond of saying that they ain't stupid. They go to the beach when it gets cold.
Oh, absolutely. And in the wintertime, I specifically have had a couple of incidences when, one with me, I was convinced that a bird had frozen to death when I was starting to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The next year I caught it in Pensacola, Florida, and I've had several incidents of people that, oh, my poor bird died, and I caught it on the beach in Florida.
That's something I'm kind of curious about. You know, obviously they can move south if they need to, and in In our cases here, we're most likely to see Anna's hummingbird in the winter, and but sometimes they just disappear mid-winter, and it is easy to think that they probably just froze to death.
Well, and I had that conversation with a lady in Juneau the other day that she had one and it died, and mm-hmm. I said, well, did you see it? Mm-hmm. And she said, no, we had kind of a warm spell, and it came to the feeder, and it just drank and drank and drank. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, that's the typical scenario for when your bird's about to leave. They don't leave when it's really cold, and that's just not good traveling weather. But they'll come to your feeder and really tank up for a day or two on a warm day. They're out of here. So don't make the assumption the bird's dead just because you don't see it anymore.
Yeah.
It's much more likely that they had somewhere else to go.
And so I guess maybe the rufous hummingbirds, they probably don't make such large crossings. I guess the ruby throat will do a cross Gulf of Mexico.
Right. We think that most of the ruby throats, and I know at least some, because you can stand on the shore and watch them come across, and also the guys out on their oil rigs and that sort of stuff see them in large numbers and that sort of thing. But we think that that's the only really cross Gulf migrant. They fight 18 hours nonstop.
Oh, wow.
But rufous and that sort of thing actually migrate in an elliptical pattern. When they come up out of Mexico, they come up through California, up through the valleys and that sort of thing, up the coast all the way into here. They start nesting about the Washington-Oregon border, up through Washington, British Columbia, and into here. But they don't go back down through California, most of them. They tend to go east a little bit, and they go down through the Rocky Mountains.
Okay.
That's when you'll see them in Idaho, large numbers in Colorado and New Mexico, down into eastern Arizona, in Texas, and back into Mexico. And we think the ones that we get in the southeast just kind of keep going east.
Yeah.
And now, because their banner's looking for them, you see them in Ohio and Pennsylvania and that sort of stuff. And then they keep just go south, and I wind up catching most of them along the Gulf Coast.
So then their nesting range then is pretty much west of like the Coast Mountains, Cascades, and
no,
or
do
they
and
on
actually
the east
we
side
don't really
also?
Understand why, but they come up to about central Washington, and some of them turn east, and they go through northern Washington, across northern Idaho, and into Montana, right up to the Continental Divide.
Oh, okay,
I used to band them there, and you can see they're on the western side of the Continental Divide.
Yeah.
Never seen one on the eastern side of the Continental Divide. But and then up into British Columbia from there, but more on the coast. But there are really not enough hummingbird banders inland in British Columbia for us to get a good data sample on what's there.
I remember I went to school in eastern Washington and so saw some from northern Idaho stuff, and that there are some patches of sort of rainforest there on the west slope of the Rockies.
Yes.
And so is that the sort of – they like – wetter relatively?
More so than some of the other birds. Yeah, the bird in that area that nests in the drier lower areas are the black-chinned hummingbirds.
Oh, okay. And so these come up north. It's interesting. There's at least one website, maybe more than one, that sort of tracks hummingbird reports in the spring.
There is. There used to be a site called Journey North.
Yeah,
I think they changed the name of that now. But you can watch that, and it's much easier in the spring,
right?
Because you know when you get the first bird,
right?
But you don't know when you have the last bird until much later. So that's very problematic for when they leave.
Yeah. And it's kind of, I mean, I guess getting here, of course, there's wide stretches. Once you leave Vancouver Island,
there's nobody out there looking for them.
Right. So there's a few communities in the middle, but it's mostly uninhabited, all the way from there. You know, you have the, in Southeast, Ketchikan, Sitka, and Juneau being the bigger communities, and some other, several other smaller communities as well. So you see these big jumps when that happens, but they don't seem to show up in Ketchikan too much earlier than they show up here. I kind of wonder, they don't move in flocks like say waterfowl or something.
No,
but
everyone's
they tend to
by
move,
itself.
I kind of wonder how much they move sort of simultaneously.
Well, let me put that in terms of ruby throats in the southeast, because that's a populated area. There, the first ones come ashore just about the 1st of March down on the coast, and there's a beautiful website that tracks them going north. And they move north about 15 to 20 miles a day.
Okay.
And you can actually track it. I can tell people, in Montgomery, you're your hummingbirds are going to start showing up in the next couple of days, and boom, there they are. And every now and then you get one that's kind of a just goes out front. And quite often in the cold weather, those birds may not make it.
Right.
But just as a general thing, you can just watch them just move north at kind of a constant rate, and they go all the way up into Canada from there.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so how fast are they flying, like the Rufus?
Well, we think that in normal flying, 30 to 40 miles an hour.
Okay.
But for short bursts, they can go well over 50 miles an hour.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, they're just unbelievably fast. But the thing that amazes you is the acceleration.
Yeah.
Because they can go from zero in your hand out of sight just almost instantly.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like a 20-mile crossing, which you have to get out here pretty much.
Oh, that's nothing.
They cover a half hour and
oh, yeah.
And that's not going to be taxing that's on there.
Not a problem whatsoever.
That's interesting. So this cross Gulf with the ruby throats, they must have to really stock up on.
Yeah, before they go, they more than double their body weight.
Oh, wow.
They get so fat, literally they can barely fly. And sometimes they get so fat they can't fly. Sometimes they will just leave the feeder and just sink into the grass. And people will call me and say, I found a sick hummingbird. And I say, well, just put it in a shoebox and call me back in an hour. And it flies off. And, oh, you've saved my hummingbird. No, the fat little pig just lost a couple of grams or a couple of tenths of grams.
Yeah.
But, they'll go from a weight of, you saw most of the birds yesterday weighed about 3 grams. That's about what a ruby throat weighs. But they'll go to 6.5 to 7 grams of fat.
Oh, wow.
And they'll, when they come off your feeder, they have to dip down to get airspeed and kind of wallow off and to fly away.
Oh, that's interesting. And so when they're heading south, like this Anna's hummingbird that you talked to the lady in Juneau about, it's probably doing something similar. May not as extreme, but in the wintertime, there's not going to be as much food along the way. So it's going to try and sort of stock up.
Yeah, and that's when I was told years ago when I started doing that, I was told that no Western hummingbirds really put on weight because all their migration is over land, but I find that's really not true.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I have found Rufus hummingbirds in southern Idaho that have almost a complete fat, and I tell people that they're going across the ocean too, but their ocean is called Nevada.
Right, yeah.
With less food resources.
Yeah, yeah, I suppose there's a lot of desert in Nevada. And,
yes.
So this is your first trip to Alaska for banding?
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. I'm just a wonderful trip, enjoying seeing Alaska and banding hummingbirds. That's truly the way to travel, is because I get to do some good science. I get to meet wonderful people and go places you would never consider without banding hummingbirds.
Yeah, yeah, and you picked some good weather for your trip. You did a good job scheduling.
Well, I thought the weather was always like this, that it's always sunny and beautiful in Alaska.
Yeah, well, it's comfortable, 60s, and it's been definitely nice weather here. I guess you got a little rain in Ketchikan, but not bad.
Yeah, not enough. It's never been enough to stop me. As long as it's not raining hard and I can get under someplace to do the banding so the bird's not getting wet while I'm handling it, it's still safe for the birds. If it starts raining very hard, I will stop because you don't want to get birds wet.
Yeah. And I guess for people that are feeding and as we go, through the summer into the fall, is there any like compelling reason to really make sure you get your hummingbird feeder down at a certain time?
Absolutely not. I tell people the very idea that you can get a hummingbird to do anything it wants to do is ludicrous.
Yeah.
That hummingbird's not going to stay 1 second in your yard longer than it's telling it for migration.
Yeah.
When it comes time to migrate, it's going to leave. It's got nothing to do with your feeder being there or not. So I would recommend here to leave your feeder up at least 2 weeks after you've seen the last bird, because there's some stragglers behind that.
Yeah.
And the birds are certainly not going to stay because you have a feeder. And out here I think that population of post-breeding dispersal Anna's may increase.
Yeah.
And you may have a chance of having an Anna's here real late in the season and that sort of stuff. And some people worry about that with warming the feeder and doing that. And I say, if you don't want to do that, just take your feeder down.
Yeah.
Don't
worry
about it.
Yeah. It seems like I've heard that the Anna's population, like in Vancouver, BC, is increased.
It's increasing greatly
and
expanding out in that area. I have no doubt that it's not going to be very long before they're going to find them breeding in Ketchikan and probably breeding up this way.
Oh, interesting. So yeah, that's something to look for. And if you are interested in seeing winter hummingbirds, and like I say, last year was a pretty good year. I heard people reporting them but they didn't seem to stick around here for whatever reason. I heard scattered reports of hummingbirds in November and December, which were probably Anna's.
Yeah, I would say the great probability of that. But, you know, unless somebody's really a birder, they just know it's a hummingbird because they're kind of hard to tell apart unless you do this a lot.
Yeah, the male Annas are pretty distinctive when you can see them as compared to the other ones. But
interestingly, and we're having them now in the Pacific Northwest. They're moving inland there, and now we have them wintering in like Boise, Idaho. There was one that wintered last year in Pocatello and that sort of stuff. But all of those birds that I've had reports for were females.
Huh.
Someone said they had an adult male up here.
Yeah, I got pictures of one. Right. That's the first one I saw, was an adult male, and its whole head was completely...
Yeah, they're pretty spectacular looking birds. They look like their head's on fire.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. When you could get the light just right, and that was a pretty cold winter, so they've got some strategies, I guess, for surviving cold temperatures.
Well, we have found that these birds are much more cold-hardy than we used to think. Mm-hmm. Back years ago when I started doing this, the kind of conventional wisdom was if it got below freezing, hummingbirds were going to die.
Yeah.
But I've seen hummingbirds where it gets down into single digits for several days. Now, when it gets, they go into overnight hibernation. It's called torpor, where they just slow everything down. And what they do that when they realize that they don't have the energy to get them through the night doing that.
Yeah.
So they'll just go into that suspended animation kind of thing and then come out of it the next morning. But they're a lot tougher than we think they are.
Yeah, and I mean, here, part of it, it's not that it's super cold here, but there's a lot of night here, It gets dark at 3:30, 4 o'clock and isn't light in the morning until 8, so they don't have a lot of daylight hours to kind of get their energy.
Yeah, see, I hadn't even thought about that. That's kind of not in my frame of reference.
Yeah.
By the time it gets dark here, I'll be in North Florida.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things that I wondered about. That first year that I was able to see those Annas, they were coming to a feeder, and it, got down into the 20s at night and not above that during the day. I mean, probably the teens at night and in the 20s during the day, and they were still pretty active.
Mm-hmm.
Probably there weren't many insects at that point.
Well, I think there are always more insects than people think. That's, you get the thing when these birds first show up in the spring sometime that there's nothing but ice and snow everywhere, and people, they can't possibly live. But, these birds, they've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's something they can live on. Just because we don't know what it is, they could care less.
Yeah.
They're just not dependent on us, and
right.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and, since those Annas started showing up and I started paying more attention in the winter, there are a lot of days, most days, in fact, when there are even below freezing days, when there are winter crane flies flying around and various winter, not as many certainly as in the rest of the year, but there are definitely things
I'm not up
around.
Here in the winter, but I'm in other places, and people say there are no bugs in the winter. You're obviously not out looking because I've never been anywhere where there weren't bugs.
Yeah, and I guess I imagine that hummingbirds are catching them out of the air, but... But if they're also foraging, like, from branches and stuff,
very definitely do. You can see birds quite often. They'll leave your feeder, mm-hmm. and you see them going up, and they're just kind of moving around in a tree and moving leaves, and they're gleaning spiders and spider eggs and small insects. And basically anything a hummingbird can get in its mouth, it'll eat.
It'll
so
eat. Huh.
They find food.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about all the things that, for me – I'm interested in natural history in general, and especially primarily for here. And having grown up here, and I think there's this tendency, you grew up and you run around in the woods and you think you know what's there, right? And it's just an ongoing exercise of all the things that I never knew were always there, And I just insects throughout the winter and all the different things. Of course, the animals that depend on them are very well aware of them. But it's very easy for us to overlook those little small things that can make a big difference for a hummingbird.
Well, and that's why I tell people all the time, not just with hummingbirds, with almost everything else. The more you learn about something, the more you realize that we don't know almost anything about them. They have their own lives and all sorts of different things, and we just kind of see bits and pieces of it.
Yeah. So I guess your goal in banding up here is get as many birds as possible.
Absolutely.
Fundamentally, banding is a numbers game of small returns.
It is, you know, in a perfect world, I want to catch a bird up here that I banded in the Southeast or band one here and catch it there.
Yeah.
I'll be very happy if any bander in the United States catches one. And, you know, I took enough graduate statistics to know that the probability of that's not very high.
Yeah.
But as I tell people, it's higher than if I didn't come up here and try.
Right.
So, you know, it's worthwhile. And no one's ever wandered around a Alaskan banded hummingbirds before.
Yeah.
So I'm just out here, and if it works, that'll be wonderful. And if it doesn't, we haven't lost anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be fun to see over the next, the next few months, really, for the first winter.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. then, you know, subsequent years, whether these birds are recaptured and you know where they end up and those stories are kind of some of the fascinating
ones. I'll certainly let you know if any of the birds in Alaska are caught anywhere else. I've kind of making a list of everywhere I go, and when the summer's over and I get back home and have some dead time before, I'll write a summary of that and post it on my website and probably send it out to most places where I banned it so that people will know. You know, it's the standard thing everywhere. People know the little slice when you were there, but they don't know all of it to kind of put it together.
Right.
I try to put that out for people.
Yeah, that'll be fun to read. And so far you've been banding. Have you found many immatures or any immatures?
None. So I think that where we are now is the adult females are through laying their eggs, and we're either in the incubation period or the young have hatched and they are feeding. And I really think we're into the feeding thing.
Yeah.
And I think we're probably within a couple of weeks, we're going to start seeing the first immature birds.
So you maybe you'll be in Haines then, or maybe I already moved on.
I don't know. They tell me that I got an email from somebody in Haines that said, how long can you stay here?
Okay.
And they said, we got lots of birds and a lot of people. And I said, I will stay there until I go to every house.
Yeah.
I came up here to ban hummingbirds, so I'm going to do it. So
and
we'll
you're not restricted by a ferry schedule to get out of there. So
no, once I get off the ferry in Haines, I'm just back to my pick-em-up truck, and we'll go as we need to.
It's been fun having you here, and I appreciate your willingness to come in and talk. And
hey, I'm not the most talkative person in the world about most things, but I can talk all day about hummingbirds.
Yeah.
They're fabulous.
Well, it's, you know, there's all sorts of stories that people have, and I imagine you get to hear lots of them as your travels.
I do, and there are probably more myths and misconceptions about hummingbirds than just about anything else, because somebody, they just see those things, and they just think they're so delicate, and they can't do this, so people just come up with all sorts of outlandish stories and things like that, and after they tell them a few times, then to them they're fact.
Yeah, well, you know, it seems like the facts as we know them so far even are pretty amazing just in and of themselves.
You know, they are, and you know, now they're starting to put trackers on birds, not near small enough to go on hummingbirds yet. But I tell people before I die, I think they'll have one they can put on a hummingbird, and we're going to learn more in 6 months than for all the banding we've ever done, and we're going to learn that at least half of everything we know is fact is not true.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of amazing. I read recently, just in the last couple of years, I think maybe it's the black swift or something in Colorado,
right.
Where they're too small to put a GPS on them, but they can record daylight length and time.
Now, they've done that with wood thrushes, a good friend of mine actually did it with 200 saw-whet owls last winter and got the grand total of zero returns. But I was watching him do that when he was working with it, and that geotracker is on their back, but it has to have a little thing that sticks up through their feathers.
Yeah.
And I said, you do realize that an owl can turn its head 180 degrees and probably just snap that thing right off. And he said, that will never happen. But maybe it did.
Maybe it did. Well, they found out with those black swifts, I think that they suspect they spend the entire winter in the air, I guess, over the Amazon basin flying. And that's where this one that was recaptured, all of the records suggested it was down there, but they're never reported from down there.
Right. Yeah. They the way they recaptured those, they went behind the waterfalls there in Colorado.
Oh yeah.
And
the nesting
at some
birds.
Danger, and they caught almost every one of them that they had done with wood thrushes. They found that some of them went directly across the Gulf, but some of them did a hard right turn and went all the way through Texas and overland down through Mexico and down into there. And what they found with all of these birds that they've put those geotrackers on is that they migrate about three times faster than we had any idea of. They move quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, back east with the density of weather radars and stuff, it's kind of fun to watch the in the evening. And I was going to ask that earlier, but do hummingbirds get affected by weather fronts and stuff very much, or are they pretty consistent in their movement, at least as far as we know?
Probably not as affected as some other birds. Mm-hmm. Some amazing things about hummingbirds is when I first started banding, I was told by people in Louisiana that they tape feeders to banisters and stuff during mm-hmm. storms, and hummingbirds will come and feed in storms. And I said, I don't believe that. But several years ago, we had a big hurricane that came through Montgomery, Alabama, and I left my feeders out, and I had hummingbirds coming to my feeders in 100-mile-an-hour winds.
Wow.
Nothing else could do that. And I think because they beat their wings so rapidly, they can be steady in those winds. And I mean, they were literally chasing each other around and acting like it was a normal day in 100-mile-an-hour winds.
Wow,
and I'm more and more impressed with them all the time.
That's amazing. So, well, again, thanks for being here, and it's been fun to get out banding. I look forward to hearing your summary and results, and any returns that you get over the next few years. And if you come back to Alaska, please come back to Sitka.
I'm certainly thinking I'm going to do that. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.